Now, On Point with Stuart Kaplan and Chris Pi-Hoda.
Chris, good afternoon.
Stuart, my friend, how are you?
I'm doing fine, and this is certainly a very, very special opportunity for you and I, because today in the studio with me is not only a friend of mine, but really someone who I think can really contribute and assist and help, you know, parents with, as we all know, we worry about the safety of our kids, and we kind of sometimes hope and pray and kind of send them off and hope that we have given them the right tools and perspective on what they should and shouldn't do. But as you know, there's a lot of bad people in the world. And so today I'm introducing retired detective Jennifer Brashear, who was a detective who recently retired from the Palm Beach Gardens Police Department. How are you, Jennifer?
I'm good. Thank you.
I when I reached out to Chris Pi-Hoda and I said, hey, listen, I want to bring Jennifer on. He was like, you know, let's hear what she's got. And he, as I was so impressed with, you know, not only what you have done professionally, but you really do care about this community, and you have certainly spearheaded some of the most prolific criminal investigations in recent times. And recently, a couple of years ago, there was a 14-year-old boy, Ryan Rogers, who was riding his bike home in November of, was it 2021?
It was 2021.
Yeah, just before Thanksgiving. And unfortunately, he ran into an individual, Semi Williams. And this was an individual who was from Miami. And unfortunately, he killed this young boy, Ryan Rogers. And talk about really the community being paralyzed, you know, with fear, because we really didn't know what was happening or who was responsible. But you, along with your colleagues, apprehended, and he is now awaiting trial, correct?
Correct. It was definitely a team event, but we did bring him to justice.
Yeah. And Chris, I've been told that, you know, we're not going to talk about that case too much because it's pending trial. So I told Jennifer I won't, you know, put her in the trick bag. But
well, still, what that does is it gives us the opportunity to invite her back once that
amen
case resolves.
Absolutely. And I understand, you know, she was a little apprehensive and she told me she was a little nervous coming in. And I said, this is a cakewalk for her. But Jennifer, you know, I always am asked by, you know, people who have kids. And as you know, certainly in this area, this is a community where there's a lot of families and there's a lot of schools and there's a lot of kids. Tell us about your perspective of your career. And, you know, look, your specialty was crimes against children, going after sexual predators and people that preyed on children. You know, talk about what that was like, you know, when you started out and how your career developed and what it's like to be in that space, knowing the responsibility that is entrusted upon you, that when unfortunately a child is victimized by someone, you know, tell us what that's like.
Hey, Stu, can I ask a question before she enlightens us on that stuff? Can you, Jennifer, I don't know you personally like Stuart does. You have me at a little bit of a disadvantage, and you had a 20-year plus policing career, so that's outstanding, and we thank you for that. When did you actually retire?
October 2022.
October of 2022. And are you a native Floridian?
I'm not. I was a military brat. My dad was Air Force, so I moved all over, but I moved to Palm Beach Gardens in 1992 when I was 16.
1992? I think that's close enough to be native now.
I was 16, so many years ago.
Yeah, that's close enough. All right, great. And one last question before you hook us up with the back. Why did you choose policing as a career?
I almost went into the military, and my older brother told me, it's not for you, sis. Don't do it. And I was like, well, I need to rethink this then. And so my next best helping in the community and helping others was going into law enforcement.
That's outstanding. I appreciate you sharing a little bit of that with us. So let's roll back into.
And by the way, Chris, I don't want to leave him out because I know him personally. Your husband, Steve, he's a police officer.
Yes.
How many years has he been a police officer?
40.
That Chris, 40. That's almost old as I am.
I salute his endurance.
Yes.
Because when I got to 25, I was done.
Yeah. So 40.
That is awesome.
Yeah. So Jennifer, tell us, you know, take us down memory lane. You know, tell us about your career and how you ended up in, and look, and I don't want you to be bashful. And ladies and gentlemen, you know, Jennifer Brashear, retired Detective Jennifer Brashear in 2018, correct me if I'm wrong, was recognized as Police Officer of the Year, right?
One of those years. I don't remember the exact year.
I looked it up. And look, there's been a lot that has been written about you in your undertaking some of the highest profile, some of the worst of the worst cases here. Not only here locally in Palm Beach Gardens, but you are recognized throughout the state as, you know, being someone who has such vast experience in solving these crimes. Talk about your career.
So my career started back in 2002. I joined the city of Palm Beach Gardens, came on as a police officer, green as can be. I was a stay-at-home mom with two kids and had went through school. Came on as a police officer, and my fellow coworker showed me the ropes, and I worked the road driving to black and white and wearing the uniform for 4 years, and never coming from any law enforcement with family, never having any law enforcement in my family, I didn't really know what the job entailed. I thought it was driving around in a car, helping people, pulling people over, stopping people from going past, you know, school buses and breaking into people's houses, you know, preventing people's property from being stolen. So when I got into law enforcement, I really didn't know what it really entailed. You can go to the schools, you can go to the classes, but you really don't understand what law enforcement has to offer and the different paths that you can take. So when I first started, it was all about driving the police car, doing the day-to-day police work, responding to calls, helping people, holding people accountable. I hate when people break the law. So I started my career, and I would write reports, and my supervisors were always on me to turn in my reports. And it wasn't through the lack of not doing my work. It was like, was never finished. I always wanted to do more. I needed to get more answers. So I always went past the road patrol officer thinking and always wanted to know what happened to the case, where, who did it. A road patrol officer, they're so busy in responding to day-to-day crime, they don't have time to take on a full case from start to finish. So you get as much as you can as a road officer, and then it pushes on to a detective, some type of investigator. So I realized pretty quickly that I liked the investigation side of it, that I was, yes, I wanted to help people out on the street, but I saw that my passion led more to what happened to a case. So after being a road patrol officer for 4 years, there was a fellow female officer that I looked up to who was coming out of the detective division. So I saw that as my opportunity, because it was all guys, it was all men. So I saw that as my opportunity to put in and maybe get up into that spot, because some people put in several times many years to get an investigator position. So seeing that female come out, I took that as my opportunity to go in, and I did get it. I was given the opportunity to work and get into investigations. And again, when I first got into investigations, I didn't know where I was, what I was doing. Your head is spinning. You're trying to figure out what your path is. And I saw from very early on that I cared about people. I cared about persons more than property. I don't know if you should say that, but it's true. I cared about more about what was happening to the people than to the property. So I naturally went that way with supervisors who probably saw that in me also, mm-hmm. allowed me to get that kind of training, take on that kind of work. And I remember very early on, because I have kids, I have my husband and I together, we have 8.
You hear that, Chris? 8.
Yeah.
8.
God bless you.
Yes. Yes. So we have 8 kids and I just had my 7th grandbaby.
Congratulations.
So I've been very kid orientated. So a lot of people are like, well, how are you going to do this? How do you care about kids too much? If you would ask me when I signed up to do police work on day one, could you ever work these type of crimes? I would have been like, oh, no way. But with the groundwork being laid and just naturally who I am and what I was into and where my passion was, it was just one day at a time. And then 10 years later, you're like, how did I become this person? You know, I can't stand this type of crime. I don't like this, what's happening out there. So, you know, 10 years later, I'm like, I'm doing this right now. Like, I'm sitting across from this guy who's admitting to doing these types of things to kids. Or, well,
and why don't you, you know, for audience and yeah. listen, it is disturbing. It's unsettling, but you know, talk about what you've seen or what your investigations were tasked with. Like, what are some of the things that you have seen in your career with respect to one human being doing to another?
So I've probably seen the worst of the worst, hence why I'm no longer a detective. I think 20 years later, I was done.
Certainly violence perpetrated against young children.
Absolutely.
Family members perpetrating violent crimes against their own kids.
Yes, mothers against their sons, grandfathers against their grandchildren, sleeping over friends, violating against people. I've seen it all. So to go back and to think about all the things that I've seen and been through, I elected and agreed to become part of our ICAC team, which is the Internet Crimes Against Children. So with seeing that, it actually broadens your.
So let's talk about that, because as you know, Chris knows, I know, and I talk about it a lot. One of my biggest fears and certainly my biggest concern is this social media, you know, society that we're living in. You know, when I went to school, it was considered cheating if you had a calculator. I mean, clearly, you know, I mean, seriously, if you brought a calculator into math class, nope, that was, you know, considered, you know, cheating. In this day and age, the kids are literally, you know, given laptop computers and phones and all these digital devices, and they all have internet capabilities. And, you know, the internet is basically the entire planet, and you can surf the world and see anything you can imagine. And so, you know, talk about, you know, the internet and the, you know, the people that are on the internet and trolling to commit and pray against, you know, praying against our younger generation. What have you seen? What do you know? And certainly I think for our audience, you know, what would you say to the parents of like what your words of advice or wisdom is?
So that's kind of a multi-answer question. So let me relate back to, I have 8 kids. So back when my younger girls were small and growing up through junior high and going into high school, this is when computers were coming around and everyone's getting a computer, putting them in their bedrooms, bringing them out. And I was young in law enforcement and going through all this. And I stopped my girls from using computers. I really held it back. We had a family computer in the living room. Teachers would always give assignments, and I was very invasive on what they were doing on the computer. And I now know many years later, I held my girls back. So they didn't get to adventure on the computers as other kids. They didn't get to see what their capabilities were, which now our whole world is computer based. So I feel like I held my older kids back. Getting to do it again, I have this another round of kids where I've got an 8-year-old, a 12-year-old, a 14-year-old, a 19-year-old. I now let them use those items. They are on social media. I now try to use what I know to teach them how to use it, because you learn as a parent, if you try to keep it from them, they're going to get it. They're going to find it. They're going to have access to it at some point. So I've now embraced, while I'm older and probably a little bit wiser, I've tried to embrace allowing my children to use it, because it's not going anywhere. It's in everything we do. It's in every phone, every tablet. You have access to all these things.
But what conversations do you have now with your children who are younger now, as you're redoing it? What do you tell them about that there are people on the internet that are actually looking to prey upon you, meaning there are dangerous people out? What do you tell them? How do you police that?
Again, I'm very open. From the time my kids started learning body parts, from the time they started talking, walking, we talk about penises, vaginas, just as they are like belly buttons and noses and ears. My kids know what their body parts are. So with social media, I include that into my talks. I let them know that there could be a neighbor next door that wants you to go play a game with them, you know, beating Mr. Doom, and it's going to involve somebody wanting to touch your vagina or somebody wanting to touch your penis. So because it's out there, without scaring them, I've just made it become normal conversation. So yeah. Ever since they were little.
My rule with my kids when they were little is, if you wouldn't do it with me standing in the room, then maybe you shouldn't do it.
You mean standing in the room with a rifle?
Yeah,
Mr. Piotta.
If I was standing there and you'd still do it, then all right, we'll talk. But if Jennifer, let me ask you a question. And you know, Stuart said, you know, you worked in the innocent, you know, that well, we used to be called innocent images for the FBI, but the crimes against children, right?
Yes.
And I used to oversee that when I had a field office program, and I used to check in on those folks a lot, because that's rough duty, right? I mean, it's hard duty, right? And I used to ask the leadership, like, how often do we provide resources for these people, these agents who work in that corrosive environment of crimes against children, child pornography, those types of things? Can you tell us, like, what were your thoughts on that across your career, as far as, I mean, that rough, again, corrosive environment, when you have to look at officer wellness? How did you maintain for so long? That's a high burnout area.
It is a high burnout, and we're offered services. People openly talk to you about going and talking to someone, even if you don't think you need it, to go talk to someone. And when you're in it and you're good and your mindset is there, you don't even think you need it. But when you realize that you do need it,
right,
that's when I wanted to get out. So when I was feeling healthy and strong and could do it, I wasn't even thinking about the mental health side. But it's very it is a very ugly side of our population. It is an ugly thing to see out there.
Is the department, or are the departments with your colleagues, is it more reliant upon self-reporting that you have to sense this is really affecting me, or do you or are there experts within your department or within the law enforcement community that are paying attention to the signals that maybe we need to pull someone out or get them some counseling?
Most definitely. I think that, especially in my unit, where you're a small enough unit, you get to know each other and you get to see how everyone is acting and what's their norms. And I think if you were to have any signs of being off, you're talked to just to check on you and see how you're doing. You have free, you know, EAP where you can go and get services. It's just my biggest problem, I'm not going to lie, because I never sought out to go talk to anybody. But the side of me that doesn't want to unleash and tell that to people, because now you have to carry it, kept me from going. So I never, honestly, my whole career, I never needed it. But when I was done, I knew I was done and I didn't want to do it anymore. Wow. And so it's an ugly side.
Well, what I tried to do in that type of program environment was we required people to go and just get what we would call the head check, right? How are they doing? How are they feeling? And this way, there was no stigma attached to it. You had to go.
Correct.
Right? It wasn't as if you were self-reporting like, hey, I feel like I'm ready to blow a gasket here, right? It was, no, everybody goes, everybody talks to people, everybody gets that kind of check out. And then, you know, if you find that you're getting that fatigue, I'll call it, right, from doing that, then you know, you offer people an out. Hey, we'll move you to another program. If you can always come back, but you know, maybe you need a break for a little while.
Right? Absolutely. I think once it's known that you're ready for a break, the rest of your law enforcement brothers and sisters realize what a tough job that is. So yeah. I've never met a supervisor or a coworker that's ever treated it other than you deserve a break. Like, take a break. You've done it. Like, you've done what others can't do. Let's get you out of there.
That is trench warfare in the kind of really, like you said, the dark part of human existence. So thanks for doing it for so many years. Again, I watched my people do it and it was hard on them.
Jennifer, I got to ask you, you know, law enforcement is gender neutral. I mean, you know, men and women, they take equal assignments. Everybody can do the same job. Do you think that in the area where you had, you know, crimes against children, that perhaps it's better suited for a female versus a male?
I think to the parents, yes. I don't really know to the victims. The victims really aren't that picky. But when you have a parent with a daughter, that parent right. usually feels better with their daughter talking to a female. Yeah. So I think it's more on the parent than the victims.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I think that's what I've always found is that the female presence was more soothing to the parent or to people in general, not a bunch of guys like Stu look like a linebacker standing around trying to be, you know, compassionate to the children. I don't think that was always that didn't always hit the mark. Right. It was always great to have some female officers or agents there to just kind of smooth that environment out. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and, you know, Jennifer, and one of the things that I personally know about you, and really it just is a absolute example of your integrity, your professionalism is, you know, personally for me, you know, as you know, I have young kids, my anger, my emotion, if I had someone who was the victim of, let's say, the most horrendous, whatever was done to them, I don't know if I could maintain, because it's a child, if my personality would always allow me to maintain my poise and objectivity and be neutral to thoroughly investigate every possible angle if I have or if there has been early on a suspect that has been identified. Do you know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. So when you first start out and you can't pull a case together because you feel that way, you eventually learn how you're going to do the next one and how you're going to do the next one. So it only takes a few not being able to get someone to talk to you because you're too angry to talk to them for you to realize you've got to do something different. So I got to the point where I was really good at talking to suspects. And my friends would say, how did you do that? How did you not reach across the table and kill them? And I would always say, because if I blow it, if I miss this opportunity, I don't get to do it again. I don't get to talk to him again. So you eventually learn from your last case what to do different from the next case and how to hold yourself and compose yourself, because you know, being able to hold your poise and carry a conversation and talk to someone is going to get a confession rather than put a 5-year-old to stand up in a courtroom. You learn to get past that anger and to hold it together so you can get that end result.
In your experience with all of the ugliness and the worst of humanity that you have seen. And so, for example, I'll admit this, you know, if you have been convicted, and when I say convicted, meaning it's the right person, they got a fair trial beyond a reasonable doubt, and you're sentenced, I don't have the ability, and quite frankly, I'll admit, I would never be forgivable. I could not forgive someone. Meaning, to me, you commit that type of heinous act, you go away. Well, I'd probably say that there are certain crimes that are less than a homicide that, to me, the punishment should be as equal to as if you kill someone. Do you believe that our criminal justice system can, or is it properly designed that, you know, people that go to jail for 10 or 15 years when they have committed these type of acts are, they can be rehabilitated and we should allow them. And I know they come out and most of them have to, you know, register as a sexual offender. Do you believe in the potential to rehabilitate these people or reacclimate them into society? Or from what you've seen, you would like agree with me that, you know, lock them away and throw away the key.
In my opinion, there's two different types. There's your preferential that did it because the opportunity was there and nothing else was there to take care of a need. And then you have the ones that target and prefer and will only seek out, you know, your younger victims. And so you've got to determine between where do they stand in that. Was it a opportunity? Can someone be rehabilitated? I don't know how you can. Just dealing with looking at people's collections of child porn. I once had a guy sit across from me and I said to him, I think the images were all under 5 and it was labeled sick and disgusting or something. And he had a whole file. And I said, how do you have that? But you've never touched a child. And he said, it's like watching a bomb blow up a building. I'm not going to go put a bomb in the building and watch it blow up, but I'll watch this. So it's like, okay, so he never touched a child. Does he need to be in society around our kids? That's too hard for me to.
Well, you know what? I think anybody who has that proclivity to consume that content at some point, if they are given the opportunity, which way are they going to go?
Absolutely. Right?
That's to me, that's the issue. And that's where we put our children at risk, is putting them around these people. I think the cost is too high to see whether or not they're going to move one way or the other at that fork in the road. I think you don't give them the fork in the road.
Right. Well, like I've told many people, because, you know, I've monitored the sex offenders that live in our area. And I try to tell people all the time that come in raising hell about this guy living across the street. And I'm like, you know what he did. You know to protect your kids. You need to worry about the other 30 neighbors around you and what they're doing.
Yeah,
and
well
people
stated.
Are like, that's true. Yeah. Like, you know not to let your kid walk over there and pet his dog. But
hey, the devil you know versus the devil you don't.
That's right.
Right?
Yep.
That's okay.
Well, Jennifer, tell us, you were telling me, I know we said we're not going to talk about the Ryan Rogers case, and that wasn't a crime against Ryan, a sexual, you know, assault. That was just a straight up homicide. But what are some of the cases in the last couple of years of your career that you had that really just, you won't forget, that really always resonate with you?
Honestly, the ones that I won't forget are the ones that aren't brought to justice.
Wow. Now, does that mean just because you weren't able to develop enough proof to arrest them?
No, I believe that there's proof to arrest them. It's proven it beyond reasonable doubt and getting it into a jury's hands. You know, so, I had a 3-year-old turning 4 told me what a man did to her, told me with 2 other women in the room, and she told us what he did, and she's young, 3 turning 4, 4 turning 5, and she's not depoed for 1.5 years, so by that time, no one's talking to her about the acts that happened that she has no idea what they are, so now she's 5 years old, parents are waiting for justice, the child goes in for a deposition, she's talking about, I don't know, unicorns and princesses, and the case is dropped. So the ones that sit with me are the ones that I can't bring to justice.
So let me peel that back a little bit. Is that a problem from the state attorney's office, meaning that they're overworked, meaning they just don't have the resources and the manpower to expedite a case to fast track it? Or is there a disconnect where these prosecutors want, you know, everything with a ribbon around it, and they want confessions and they want the smoking gun, and they're just not willing to go the extra mile? What's the disconnect there?
Well, law enforcement has probable cause, right? We have probable cause to arrest someone. And in the courts, the prosecutors, they need to believe in a case and need to know that the person did it with beyond reasonable doubt before they bring it to trial. I think the disconnect is between the officer's reasonable doubt, or I'm sorry, the officer's probable cause and the prosecutor's reasonable doubt. But you also now have a defense side that can delay things. They know that it's a 3-year-old victim. Know if we are delaying things and things aren't happening quickly, that child's going to eventually, you know, when you're 3 years old, when you're 5 years old, when you're 8 years old, when you're 10 years old, and you don't understand sexual acts, it's hard to explain that and be credible as knowing what you're talking about, that something happened to you. So I think I don't think it's any one thing's to blame. I don't think it's one person's or one system's. I think there's a lot of failures. You know, suspects have the right to speedy trial, but victims don't have the right to speedy trial.
Yeah, I mean, the cases sometimes languish. And just like you said, a year later, the recollection of a 3-year-old is almost going to be impossible. You know, I'll tell you, I find it fascinating that we're having this conversation because many of the states, as you know, have done away with the statute of limitations, at least on the civil side, where someone who was a minor who was sexually assaulted or sexually abused can now go after a person who victimized them, meaning 20 years later, now that they're an adult, something has happened where they can now go after that person. I find it interesting because the experts will say that a 3 or 4 or 5-year-old may be able to suppress, or they'll just go on with their lives, and then there'll be a triggering event maybe in their adult life where they are in discourse or they're rebelling or something, and they go to therapy and all of a sudden it comes out where they relive this trauma when they were 3 or 4 or 5 years old. And so it's interesting because the sad part and the tragic part is like a case you said where a 3 or 4-year-old has clearly been victimized. You know, that trauma at some point may rear its ugly head again in their lives.
Absolutely. We've seen that. So that child doesn't know that those acts are bad at 3 and 4 years old. So they're not thinking about them. And families are encouraged not to talk to the child about the case, to kind of just let it be so they don't look like they have been tampering with their testimony. But now when that child becomes older and that same child starts having a sexual relationship with somebody and she's does those acts again, it now brings back those memories back to that child's memory. I've seen it where we had a boy from the time he was 5 to 12 was molested by his mother, and he didn't want to see her go to prison, and he refused to testify. She admitted to it, apologized. And from the time he was 12 to 17, she didn't victimize him. But when he turned 17, he couldn't even hold it together. That's because he's now getting into that age of understanding what those acts are. So going back, even when 12, when he first reported to try to get things to stop, he still didn't understand what sexual acts were. He didn't know how bad those things were. It wasn't until he got into those future hormones and mindsets of wanting to pursue it with somebody. Now all those things that happened to him as a young boy start weighing on him, and now it's bothering him. So
it's unfortunate. Hey, Stu, can I ask Jennifer a question? Since she's come out of the local police department environment, Jennifer, how did you see the change over the last maybe 5 to 7 years, the sentiment toward law enforcement? Right, there's that kind of change in sentiment around society toward our law enforcement professionals. How did you see that impact your career, your work in the, you know, crimes against children area? Did you see any of that impacting you? And then I think you were already, you retired 2022. No, you were around for the whole defund the police circus that happened and everything. What are your thoughts on that?
So seeing those things happen and going around and around me, not exactly where I worked, because I'm very thankful where I work. Like I'm not just saying we have the best residents. We have the best. If you work in City of Palm Beach Gardens, you've got it good. And your residents, there's not a time you don't put on a uniform and they're not trying to buy your dinner, buy your lunch. You sit down to eat with three coworkers on a training day. You go to pay and your bill's been paid. So right here,
supportive community.
But we watched it go down and listen to people talking. When I first got into law enforcement, I was in the police academy during 9/11. So on 9/11, I was in the police academy, and I remember coming out, everybody loved the police and fire. And it was just, and again, I had no previous law enforcement experience or anything in my family to really know whether people hated or loved the police. But watching that downfall and watching where the police are now the enemy, it was disheartening. And it, you know, your officers that are there to do their job are still going to do their job. Whether you hate them one day and you're calling 911 the next day, you're still going to go and respond and do the work. But it's very discouraging. And to see what's happening around you where your head's on a swivel, you know, you're there to protect people. You're there to take the bad guys to jail. And now you don't know who the bad guys are. It was very disheartening. And
I'm sorry, Chris, you went through the changeover where body cameras became part of the department issued equipment, correct?
Yes, but I wasn't on.
I know you were a detective, but yes. Do you recall whether that was a positive reception or was there pushback from the cops who were going to be now required to wear that?
I don't really know how the cops feel because I wasn't on the road back then. I know as a detective, I loved it. I loved being able to see an officer's first interaction with a child or with a victim and see what they said and how was the demeanor and what was the circumstances. So for investigations, it was a beautiful tool. There is another side to it where everything's now on body-worn camera. And so now that teenager is looking at that body-worn camera like, I'm not talking to you until that's turned off. But
right. And
I don't know that I'd want to be a cop with a body worn camera on all the time. I probably would get myself in trouble with talking on the phone or having a conversation I probably shouldn't. But, you know, the officers that are wearing it 24, you know, their entire shift, you know.
Yeah, I think it changes the dynamics of the law enforcement environment. And I think it changes your behavior. And it also changes the behavior, as you said, of people who you're interacting with.
I've seen more where it has helped an officer, someone come, because when you're interacting with a law enforcement officer, I feel some people take it as a negative defensive interaction. Mm-hmm. So they see it differently than actually maybe what had happened. And not that they're trying to lie, but they just don't see it the same way as everybody else would see it. So it's nice to have that body-worn camera there to say, that's not what happened at all. Here you go.
Well, I've seen too many instances where people are now trying to bait the police officers into a conflict. And then they, you know, everybody's standing around them with their smartphones out, just waiting for an incident to happen where the body cam provides that, I would say, objective footage as opposed to something that's been, you know, kind of dolled up for the internet. Right. But do you think that the adoption of the body cam has made law enforcement more passive on certain issues?
I do. I think it makes them realize, stop and think, like, instead of getting the job done and trying to come to a quick resolution, and sometimes you need to be quick to come to a better resolution, I think that they'll second guess themselves. But if they're doing the right thing, I always try to tell the people that that ask me these questions about body worn. Imagine being in that officer's shoes. If you're just in a restaurant and someone does something to you, even just says the wrong comment, you're going to go off. You're going to get defensive. That officer is just reacting to something that has provoked him. It's still a person. It's still somebody with feelings. And now they're trying to do a job and make sure everybody's safe while they're being now provoked. And it definitely changes the dynamics.
But yeah. So your department was involved in one of the more high profile officer involved shootings, right? Many years ago, Norman Raja, right?
Yes.
And Corey Jones was the victim.
Yes.
And I will tell you, and I'm on record saying this, back then it was Chief Stepp, right? Steve Stepp. And I have to tell you that those were very difficult times for your department, because there was a story or a storyline that unfolded that, you know, just didn't necessarily jive with the physical evidence. But I was so impressed that the chief at the time, Chief Stepp, he didn't really agonize too long in being more concerned about protecting the individual officer, as he really, I think, did what a lot of departments have failed to do, and that is to look at the overall impact on the department itself, on how this isolated particular case can impact the integrity, the credibility of all of our officers. And I was quite impressed on the way he handled that case, because they fired the officer not too long after the shooting, obviously. But I felt that there have been too many situations where at least the public's perception or the optics is that they're looking to protect the officer versus the unfortunate victim. And especially some of those high profile cases where there's video of the incident, you just say, my God, you know, how could that officer still, you know, be a member of that department? Now, there's a strong police union, and, you know, the police union comes out and tries to protect these individual officers. But part of the evolution and the pushback of wanting body cameras is because there came a certain point where the public didn't trust the police officers. And you touch upon an important facet that law enforcement officers are just like everybody else. They're human. They have emotions. They have, you know, certain tolerance and patience. And then at some point you can push the button and someone can react. You know,
well, I'll tell you, just from my own interaction.
Now, by the way, Chris, Jennifer got very, very quiet here. I just want to let you know. I don't know. She's like, don't drag me down that road.
Just waiting for what the question was.
No, to me,
honestly, the body worn cameras, good cops want good cops on the street.
Yep.
Good cops don't want bad cops on the street. And that's how I feel. And that's how I feel like the people I worked through this profession felt. None of us like it when another cop tarnishes our badge. And we all know that we have to make up for what another cop does. So body-worn cameras are there to, one, remind you that you are going to be judged and you are going to be, you know, people are going to be able to watch the call,
but it's
just like if they were there.
But culturally, there is such a reluctancy and such a hesitancy to terminate or fire a police officer when you know the officer screwed up. It just seems that that culture is designed to protect its own.
Have you heard of the PBA?
You fire people
and they have their jobs in a month, in a year.
But to your point, I think to some extent that does a disservice to the good cops.
Absolutely.
Because they're then fighting to leave a knowing bad cop in place, where all that bad cop is doing is eroding the community's trust and confidence in the department. And I say that's a very selfish position.
But that comes down to the ability of the leadership in a law enforcement organization to navigate the social issues and the political matters. That's what they do. The leadership, they're the dragon slayers when it comes to negotiating those political and social challenges, right? It, to me, when you're looking at an officer, I've seen in the shooting investigations where they'll say it was a good shoot, meaning, of course, that it was within policy, it was within protocol, it was within a certain set of parameters. But was it the right thing to do in the public's eye? That's where you start running afoul. So, you know, Jennifer, when you're looking at that from your perspective as, you know, senior detective, and you can say, yeah, it was a good shoot, but it wasn't a good shoot.
For sure. We have to all live with the decisions made by other officers and what they did. The hard thing is, and I'm not trying to, I've been a police officer. I've been a detective, and it's always easy, as we say, to Monday morning quarterback. And I think a lot of officers, it's not that they want to go against what their fellow coworker did. It's just hard to know what they thought in that situation and what they felt at the time. And so I don't know that officers will back up an officer that made the wrong decision or try to question why, because trying to understand why someone felt something or the spider senses they got, what did they see that we weren't picking up on? I think agencies owe it to those officers to determine and to properly investigate what did they see, what happened.
Right.
But then it's up to, I'm not an IA guy. But
it's just as being a law enforcement professional, you watch these things because it impacts how your life as a police officer goes.
Yes.
Right. Stu, let me give her a real quick example of something. When we used to bring people in, and we used to bring them as Stu, remember the Citizens Academy? We would bring people in from the, you know, civilian side. We'd run them through like an 8 to 10 week course to familiarize them with what the FBI did. Well, one of the nights was we'd bring them into the firearm training simulator room, right? The whole FATS machines, where you get the whole simulated firearms. You have the laser guns, and you give them scenarios, whether it's shoot, no shoot, all that good stuff. Some of them would come in, and we would tell them. I would start it out and say, look, you're here among friends. You're in a friendly environment. These scenarios were created to challenge your reaction, your judgment, everything, your marksmanship. Some of the people came in, and they were excited to do it. And when the scenario changed to just, it was a shoot scenario, they couldn't shoot. They froze. They just completely could not shoot. They just were horrified, because they were scared. And then there was the other side of the folks who shot 47 rounds. And then, because, you know, you didn't have to reload. It was just pull the trigger. And then we would ask them, like, how many rounds did you shoot? I don't know. You know? Yeah, you shot 47 rounds. And then they started understanding. Like, and again, they're in a friendly training environment, not a hostile environment, where most police officers have to go from incident to incident to conflict to conflict. And I think that's what gave them better perspective. When they left there after that night, they had a whole new understanding of what the law enforcement officer goes through. And that's for the FBI. That's not, we don't have anything like the regular duties of a police officer on patrol.
Yep.
Right. Yep. We have that at our local agency, which was really nice, because you could put people through that and they saw it differently. So I've seen people go in and change their reactions to shoot, don't shoot.
Absolutely.
So I want to put you on the hot seat.
Okay.
In your career, did you ever interact with a police officer or observe a police officer? You just said that person should not be a police officer.
I honestly did not. There's no hot seat there.
Okay.
I had some that need to be educated, put things in a report or to change, but for 16 years, I sat in an investigations unit that was just surrounded by upstanding people. So other than someone that maybe had a bad attitude or maybe got in a fight with their wife and they came to work mad or angry, but I had the privilege of seeing law enforcement in a very positive light. And I didn't see what we were seeing on the news. Even for me, it was disturbing, because I'm like, what do you mean this, this is happening? And, you know, thankful for the city of Palm Beach Gardens.
Well, and it's funny, because I would have been surprised if you said that you had, because I'm very intimately familiar with that police department. And I have to tell you, I think it really sets the gold standard. I mean, I have to tell you, the Palm Beach Gardens Police Department really does set the gold standard. The level of professionalism from anybody that I've interacted with really is incredible. But you and I were talking, Chris, before Jennifer came in here, and she said that the police department, even Gardens, is having a tough time hiring people, right?
Well, standard, you know, you've got to vet them. You've got to interview them. You can't just pick any random person off the street. And
so
Gardens is a tough place to get into.
Okay. And so I guess my question is, do you think we as a society here in the United States, have we relented and given in to what our expectations need to be in the law enforcement community just to accommodate, to be able to fill vacancies and hire? Or do you see it some other way?
I see it another way. I see it as society is pushing out good cops, and they're pushing out people that want to be there and to make a difference. You know, me, if you would have asked me 15 years ago, I would have encouraged my son to become a law enforcement officer. And now, 19 years old, I've told him he could do anything in the world but become a law enforcement officer.
Now you're on the hot seat.
I'll be on the hot seat.
Why?
Because law enforcement isn't what it was. You're not respected. When you can drive in a police car and be shot at, or you don't know who... When I first got into law enforcement, it was so obvious who the bad guys were. It was the person out there committing the crimes, and your everyday citizens wanted to help you get them.
So it's not a reflection of the internal department, meaning you're not saying, I don't want my son to be a police officer because I don't like the way the department is being run.
Absolutely not.
You're saying it from the opposite, from a different perspective of that. You don't like the way our society has basically rewarded our criminals and kind of, you know, just allow the revolving door.
Absolutely.
And as a result, cops are not looked up to. They're not respected. And
Stuart, I was a 47-year-old female with a great career ahead of me, and I retired at 20.
But
my husband's doing 40 and going to retire.
But
I considered, guess what I call myself? I told him, I'm a quitter.
Yeah, but, you know, Jennifer, so let me get on my soapbox. This is where it is so concerning to me, because people like you are irreplaceable to the younger people that are coming up through the ranks. So my biggest concern is, listen, and Chris and I talk about this all the time, I am so worried for this generation that is coming, you know, through high school, you know, and then whatever they do after. And so that's going to be our police community, our law enforcement community. Who's going to have the experience and the knowledge and the wisdom to train them?
The so mentors. They don't. Yeah,
where, are the, where are the mentors? So you listen, and I get it. We talked many times, and I get why you surrendered. But are you not concerned, and how do we fix that? Because if someone like you leaves where you knew you had a lot more gas in the tank, but you just said, look, this is not the career for me anymore. It's not what it was. And I certainly would never recommend it to my 19-year-old. I mean, at 19, 20 years, to tell a kid, hey, go into the police academy, become a cop, back when I was growing up, that was amazing. I mean, who didn't want to be a police officer, a firefighter? I mean, not alone be an FBI agent. And I hear that all the time. So my question to you, and I'm sure the people listening to this want to know, how do we fix that?
I don't know. I don't know. I can tell you there are still good people stepping up to fight the fight. And maybe as a society moving forward, we start, and not right here local, because I'm telling you, and I can't even say it. In Palm Beach Gardens, I was treated really, really good. Our residents are amazing. You can't walk. You can't do a foot patrol without being thanked by a resident. So I'm not talking right here locally. I'm talking on a broader.
No, this is a societal.
People that
disease.
Know and need that they know that you want. You don't know you need law enforcement till you need them.
Yeah.
You know, a law enforcement officer is responding to your worst day every day. So everybody's worst day every day, law enforcement is responding. As a society, you've got to stop putting everyone in one cat. If we all chose not to go to a doctor because a doctor made a mistake on an operating table, right, we're all in trouble, right?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, I said it on one of our previous shows, but I think what people have to understand, and I saw this written somewhere, they said, be careful criticizing our first responders, law enforcement, and everyone else. They leave their families every day to protect yours.
That's right. For 20 years, my kids have been left with caregivers and family members every hurricane. Right.
So that you can protect them. You protect other people. Hey, Stu, I know we're probably running short on time. Can I throw one other thing at Jennifer?
Absolutely.
And don't think you're getting out of the speed round.
I know, but I have one other topic because I promised that I would have her respond to this. Go ahead, Chris.
Sure. All right. Jennifer, tell us quickly or as much as you want about you were noted as saving the lives of three young ladies who nearly drowned at one point.
Yes, at Du Bois.
So
Mother's Day weekend, myself and some family went to Du Bois, and we were in the area that's in between, not the Du Bois where the water comes in, where you go to Crab Island, but Du Bois, right by the intercoastal, there's a little cutout of rocks that allow not a lot of water to come in. And all these kids were playing, no parents in sight for some of them. And my little girl at the time was just toddling around, and she lost her float and turned around, and three girls that she had been playing with were gone. And I look over, and in an area where it drops off, where the rocks open up, I looked over and I, 2 seconds in, realized they weren't swimming. And my sister grabbed my child while I went and grabbed them. And one of them clung to me and pulled the other two out. And one got saved. One got the water cleared out right on scene. The other one had to be taken to St. Mary's. The parents were fighting with me to try to take their kids from me. I'm sitting here. Of course, I'm a mom. I don't look like a cop, or I don't have any authority, but I'm trying to tell them that your kid needs help. And luckily the fire rescue was on scene because somebody else had called for somebody on a surfboard. So we ran over and got them and was able to get those girls, you know, nice and safe, and they lived.
That's an amazing story. That is a great story.
Great that you were there.
Amen. Jennifer, in this day and age, if you were in a auditorium just filled with dads and moms and dads and loved ones who have kids, what would you tell them? What should they be looking for, and what should they be doing in their efforts to try to keep their kids safer?
So start by being very open and talking to them. You cannot shelter these kids anymore. When I grew up, my parents didn't have to talk to me about sex. They didn't have to talk to me about boobs. They didn't have to talk to me about intercourse. It's there. Our kids can find it. And if you don't tell them about it, somebody else is. So from early on, just like you do everything else, you teach them in stages. From the time they can talk, you teach them their body part names. As an investigator, I can't tell you how hard it is when a child tells a teacher or tells a friend or tells another parent, you know, daddy put his pee-pee in my pee-pee, or, you know, Uncle Harry touched my cookie. You know, people don't know what to take from those situations because they're not real scenarios. The one case, the little girl told her teacher they were late to the Curious George movie because daddy put his pee-pee. She had to touch daddy's pee-pee and then mommy had to touch it. If the girl would have known that urine is pee, penises are penises, vaginas are vaginas, it would have saved us a whole lot of time. We eventually found out dad peed in the shower. Mom yelled at him because she had to touch the urine. Then the little girl has to touch it when she takes baths. So she had to touch daddy's pee-pee and mommy had to touch it. So teach your kids their body parts. We want to teach them about social media and all these. Teach them about the acts that are happening. Of course, you don't have to go into a five-year-old. They're going to see someone kissing on TV. Let them know that kissing is for older people, and that type of kid, they're going to see it. So if you don't teach them and you think your kids are too young, I've been asked before, you know, should I let my 12-year-old go to a sleepaway camp? Well, does he know what the penis does and what happens to it? And that people know? Well, then I wouldn't send my kid. You know, you have to educate your kids. If you don't educate them, other people are. They're walking with kids with phones, with YouTube. We have instant access to pornography. So I've taken the steps to educate my kids, of course, not to tell them of the things you're going to see, but I want them to have an idea of what the verbiage is and the words out there. So when they hear it or see it, they know how to come back and talk to me. Right. Don't ever push people on your children. You know, kids have a good, if your 3-year-old, 4-year-old liked somebody up until last week and they don't like them anymore. Your 4-year-old's too young to tell you why. You're just going to have to work off of it. You're going to have to move forward. No matter where you live, you can live in the best places and it's going to happen. Anything can happen anywhere. Educate your kids. Any type of device, you as a parent should have access passwords. My kids know if I can't pick up your phone and get into it, your phone's gone. So my thumbprint's in it. I better have the password.
You know, it's funny you say that. When my kids were little, I told them, smartphones weren't a thing yet when my kids were smaller. But I told them, I will invade your personal space as I see fit.
Absolutely. Right? It's my space.
You know, whenever I feel like there's a need, I will invade your personal space. But now these kids think they have a right to privacy. And that makes me laugh.
Starts with parenting. You have to educate them early on. Teach them their body parts, the proper names. If it's normal in your household and in your conversation, it's not a big secret. And I'll tell you something else. When you're parenting a young teenager and you tell him you better not or you're in big trouble, I would stay away from that because you're now going to have that you better not smoke weed or you're in big trouble. You now have weed given to a teenager. They're too scared to come and tell you and somebody can use that against you. So rethink your parenting line about, you do this, you're in big trouble. You could still come talk to me. There may be a consequence, but they've got to know they can come to you and the fear can't be there. They don't want you to find out. We tell our kids every day, you don't send nude images on your phone or you're in trouble. You're going to lose your phone. You're going to lose all your privileges. Well, now when they do that, they're too scared to come and tell you. And then they get into situations where the suspect is making them send more or they're going to tell on them. So I would really open up that line of communication where I wouldn't tell them the consequences. I would tell them they can come talk to you no matter what they do. Don't put the fear in them when you find out that their life is over because they're going to make sure you don't find out.
Definitely a different set of parenting paradigms these days than when I grew up.
I've had the luck. Like I said, with 8, I kind of got to mess up on the first ones. I've now got the last ones I can kind of.
You got it fine tuned now.
Yes.
Jennifer, it's riveting though to listen to that because it really does make sense. And it really comes down to really having confidence to communicate openly with your kids.
Yes.
And don't, you know.
We are a society that want to shelter our kids from people, you know. I learned as I did investigations, it drew me to have conversations with my kids. For instance, the one I said, Dr. Doom, my son was maybe 6 years old at the time. And another boy about 4 years older was a neighbor and told the boy, let's play this game. And the only way you can win is to perform a sexual act. Well, this little 6-year-old wanted to win this game. So he went along with it. So I would go back and then I wouldn't say exactly what happened. I would say, you know, hey, listen, if you're down the street and this kid wants to play this game and he says, you've got to look at his penis, are you going to do it? No. Well, will you tell on him? No. Well, what if he does that to your little brother? What if he does it to someone else? Don't you think you should tell on him? So I educated my kids. They're probably a little more educated than others. You know, they know where babies come from. There's nothing shameful in talking about our body parts. Just educate your kids or someone else is going to.
In your experience, do you find parents reluctant or resistant to listen to someone like you because every parent believes they know how to do it better? Or do you, because listen, I'm listening to you and I think it's incredible because you have given me a lot of things to think about because I am very hard. Certainly on my son, because the internet scares the crap out of me because, as you said, I don't want him to do something that later on life can be held against him because once it's on the internet, it's on there forever. And I am, you know, my wife thinks I'm, you know, heavy on him because I guess I react in fear for him, the consequences. Ironically, you're really saying it's more of the open communication so that he feels that confidence and that level of trust to be able to communicate and talk to me about things.
Right. If your son was out on prom night and was drinking and driving, have you scared him to the point of don't call you? Or does he know he can call you? He's going to be in trouble, but
I think I told him at 40, he would get out of the room at 40. Like I'd unlock the bedroom
right,
at 40.
But when it comes to sexual acts and our body parts, we seem to shut things down rather than talking about them. So we're now scaring the kids. A lot of kids won't even say the word penis. They won't say the word vagina. And it's like, it's no different. It is an ear. It is a nose. You have an eyeball. You have a hand. If you teach them when they're 2 years old, that is a penis, and you talk about it as it's normal, which it is. Everybody's got one or the other.
Well,
you have to educate your kids or someone else is going to. But yes, I think people are opening to listen to me. Most people would say, how was your day today? I'd be like, good. But if I give them an inkling of what I do, that's what they want. They want to pick my brain apart about how to make their kids safe, how to help them. And
do you think you're in a better position to speak to children? Meaning, let's say I brought you into a high school, you know, ninth graders or even eighth graders or seventh grade, middle school, let's say sixth, seventh, and eighth grade. Do you think you could get that across to them? Or do you think this is a conversation that needs to be with the parents or collectively with both?
Collectively with both. You should start with the parents and see where your kid takes it. But parents can say it till they're, what my dad used to say, till he was blue in the face. Yep. But they hear it from a law enforcement officer. You as a parent could tell them it's illegal to send a picture of your nude body to somebody else. But they hear it from law enforcement or somebody, you know, in the criminal back in law enforcement.
Right.
They're going to listen to it a little bit more. Do they still do it? Yes. Kids are impulsive. They don't think about every consequence and every react. They don't know what we know is the big picture, that you could possibly send this picture to someone and they may be interested in coming to abduct you.
Gotcha.
You know, you just have to have an open line of communication. Don't scare them to the point where they're too scared to tell you they fell for it, because that's what these kids are doing. You can tell them all day long, do not send a nude image. They still send it, and now they don't know how to deal with it, and it just unravels because they know you told them not to. As a parent, you've got to find that space that, yes, you're the boss and there's a consequence, but it's more important that your kid can come to you and talk to you.
Excellent advice.
That's good. All right, Stuart. I know you're putting it off.
All right, Chris. Jennifer doesn't know about this, so
fasten your seatbelt. Jennifer, we like to do this thing there. I asked Stuart.
How stupid I am.
So. No, it's just fun facts. Go ahead. Stu tries to answer the questions, and we hope to throw out some trivia to the audience. It's just the way we do it. But, Stuart, how many law enforcement officers are there in the United States?
I'm going to say, when you talk about and you consider just Los Angeles Police Department and New York City, I will say there are 400 sworn law enforcement officers in the United States. 400,000.
Oh, okay. I say 400.
I know, 400,000.
All right. That's a good guess, but it's between 700 and 800,000 sworn.
I'm a little shy.
In the United States. Here's another one. How many number of law enforcement officers in the state of Florida?
I would say there are 35,000.
Close, but no cigar, my friend. 47,000.
Closer. All right.
Last one is, what is the percentage of law enforcement officers that are females?
I would say the ratio in 2024 is 75 male, 25% women.
13% female.
Wow.
And just for comparison's sake, when I was still at the Bureau hovered between about 17 to 20%.
Do you see that as well, Jennifer, in the local departments? You know, still disparity with it being a male, predominantly male?
It is majority male, but there are so many females that are out there also. that are there.
Right.
So I wouldn't even be able to guess. I would have failed that trivia question.
Yeah. So 13% on a national level.
Did not know that.
So Stuart, I'm going to do the gratitude and close and thank Jennifer. And then you get the last words with Jennifer. So Jennifer, what we like to do is always thank our law enforcement, first responders, military folks, everybody who keeps society running day to day. We like to throw them a thank you every time we do a show. And I want to thank you for your dedication to the law enforcement profession. I know over the course of your career, you've made a lot of sacrifices in supporting the communities and keeping everybody safe. So something that can't ever adequately be rewarded or appreciated, but I know everybody did appreciate it. So thank you very much, Stu. Last words are yours.
Yeah, I will just say, you know, Jennifer, we've never had really this kind of, you know, forum or intimate conversation. I will tell you, Jennifer, I personally think you have a lot of gas left in the tank. And I know what some of your thoughts are with what you may want to do in your future. I think you have that gift to mentor and create a space for yourself to pass along your wisdom, your advice, your expertise, whether it's to younger police officers or at the high school level, elementary level, middle school level, to do presentations in front of parents or student bodies. I mean, Jennifer, your roadmap, and I think you even self-profess this, is you are a completely different person now than you were 20 years ago. Is that a fair statement?
Yes.
And it is because of what you have seen. And what's interesting is it really is, unfortunately, the worst of humanity that kind of created this wisdom that makes you as smart as you are and have the gift of not only just, you know, opining your personal experience, but like you have real life experience testing of what works and what doesn't work. That's a gift. And it would be a shame if you didn't take your gift and pass it off to others so that they could hopefully maybe avoid some of the pitfalls in life. And most importantly, at least personally to me, is our children are so vulnerable in this world today with social media and just the ability for people to prey upon them, that you could, you know, give this incredible advice to these kids that are coming, you know, up in our society. Because look, people generally, mom and dad are working, right? Mom and dad have to work because things are so expensive and mom is going one direction, dad's going in the other. And, you know, the kids go to school and you leave it for a hope and a prayer that our teachers are going to somehow give them the right guidance and direction. And I don't mince words. I think there's a lot of craziness that's even going on in our schools where these kids are not even, or at least they're being fed or indoctrinated with this garbage. But you bring back some really incredible real life experience that I think is so valuable. And it would be a shame for someone like yourself not to pass it along, because I know you can just do incredible things and continue to do incredible things in your life that has just begun in your second career. And I really cannot thank you enough. And Chris, we're going to bring Jennifer Brashear back on because there needs to be a part two.
Well, she left the door open when that other case resolved. Yes. We can talk about that a little bit.
Yes.
Plus, we didn't get any of her hobbies. We didn't get any of her personal stuff. So,
and I have
ran out of daylight.
And you know my wife, Jennifer, I have some of her girlfriends that are moms, and they worry. You know, they worry when they send their kids to school and how to handle this. I'm going to bring some of those moms on, and you're going to come back, and we're going to have this real conversation of what, you know, parents go through each and every day. And hopefully, look, you just gave some, I mean, incredible wisdom, and thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.